in today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy.
As the evidence from this tribunal will show that conditions facing Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples residing in the United States during the 21st century amount to genocide.
Highlights of the International Tribunal on U.S. Human Rights Violations.
Because slavery in the United States has never been abolished. Understand what I'm saying? Slavery in America has never been abolished. It's been penalized. It's been put in the prison system.
Including discussion of mass incarceration, political prisoners, and police terror.
What about the undisclosed or forced sterilization of thousands of Black women in the South, Indigenous women on reservations, and of women in Puerto Rico? All of our institutions, healthcare institutions included, our entire culture, this country's founding laws and practices are super saturated with racism.
As well as systemic health and environmental racism in the United States.
The panel of jurors heard testimony emphasizing millions upon millions of Indigenous and African peoples murdered, disappeared, and nearly exterminated over a period from 1492 through the present. Further, the witnesses and prosecution argued that the wrongs have been historic and deliberate.
And the verdict is in.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates. I'm your co-host, Bob Lederer, one of the producers of Out FM, covering anti-racist LGBTQ plus issues on WBAI in New York, and a member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. Here along with Akua Holt, host of Pan-African Journal on KPFT in Houston.
Today we'll share excerpts of a historic People's Tribunal convened October 22nd to October 25th, 2021 in New York City. Hundreds of human rights activists gathered in person and worldwide virtually for the International Tribunal on Human Rights Abuses Against Black, Brown, and Indigenous Peoples. It was organized by the In the Spirit of Mandela Coalition, created in 2018. A multiracial group of organizers, academics, clergy, attorneys, and others.
The proceeding built on a long line of people's tribunals and other efforts to internationalize U.S. human rights violations. The event was held at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Center, former site of the Audubon Ballroom, where Black human rights leader Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965 after calling for the U.S. to be brought before the World Court.
The day after the testimonies at the Church Center for the United Nations, a distinguished panel of international jurors, a majority of them women and rooted in the Global South, found the United States guilty of a variety of human rights abuses, including genocide. We'll hear excerpts toward the end of the hour.
We'll begin with part of the opening statement by the Chief People's Counsel, Nkechi Taifa, an internationally acclaimed human rights attorney. Nkechi has been a senior fellow at the Center for Justice at Columbia University and member of the National African American Reparations Commission. She led a team of seasoned attorneys and Howard University law students who directed the 2 full days of testimony from over 20 impacted victims, expert witnesses, and professionals with firsthand knowledge and data raised in the 5 counts of the tribunal's indictment.
Nkechi Taifa.
In 1903, upon the launch of his seminal treatise, The Souls of Black Folk, historian W.E.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line, referring to the pernicious role of race in U.S. society. And now, more than 100 years later, his prognosis is even more ominous, as the evidence from this tribunal will show that conditions facing Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples residing in the United States during the 21st century amount to genocide. This charge is not the ranting and raving of wild-eyed militancy, but as you will see from testimony and exhibits during this tribunal, results from a careful and methodical analysis of over 400 years of examination and study. So this tribunal today, while not unique, seeks to once again unabashedly charge genocide. But this time, Rather than a sole reliance on the international treaty, the convention to prevent and punish the crime of genocide, the only vehicle available when the original 1951 petition was brought to the UN. Today, we also seek jurisdiction based on the implementation of that international treaty as documented within the United States Code. Although this tribunal seeks to use the international definition of genocide as a lens to scrutinize five key issue areas: policing, mass incarceration, political prisoners, environmental racism, and public health system inequities, and their impact on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, the genocidal impact in other systems such as education and the racial wealth gap, et cetera, could likewise be so examined. I would be remiss if I did not unfortunately acknowledge that the term genocide appears to singularly conjure in most minds images of fiery ovens and atrocious massacres. And as such, there is often a blanket denunciation of the applicability of that term to the United States. This censure, while understandable from the colonizer's standpoint, is myopic from the viewpoint of the colonized. Seldom does the colonizer class dispassionately examine the internationally accepted parameters of the term genocide and then methodically apply that definition to the impact of United States policies and practices on particular racial groups. Or if one were to do so, and this tribunal attempts to do such, we hope that you will agree that the definition of genocide against a substantial segment of the Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in the United States is a reality. You will hear in either testimony or documentary evidence that genocide, whether committed in a time of peace or in a time of war, is a crime under international law, which the contracting parties undertake to prevent and to punish. Genocide, the convention declares, is the committing of certain acts with, quote, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, religious group. Now, the UN General Assembly adopted the Genocide Convention in 1948 without dissent, with the United States being the first nation to sign. Indeed, the U.S. delegation played a pivotal role in drafting the International Convention. However, it took the United States 38 years to give its advice and consent to ratification. And one of the articulated reasons for this unconscionable delay was the fear that Black folk in the United States would use the treaty to their advantage. During this tribunal, you will learn that the United States inflicts police racism and violence against Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, that the United States systemically executes Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities through the unchecked practices of police brutality, the manufacturing of hypercriminalization, and the perpetration of slow death conditions. Indeed, racially biased and extrajudicial killings against Black people, whether by lynch mobs or officers of the law, fall within the definitional prongs of the Genocide Convention. You will learn that the United States perpetrates a criminal legal system that results in a mass incarceration unparalleled in the world. You will hear testimony that the United States has refused to acknowledge and subsequently address clear evidence of systemic racial bias while systematically criminalizing poverty to the specific detriment of Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. You will also learn that the oppression and struggle against oppression in the United States has resulted in a class of political prisoners and prisoners of war peculiar to the historic, ongoing, and now normalized reality of colonialism and genocide in the United States imposed upon Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, which started with the incursion and the occupation of the Americas by white settlers from Europe in 1619 and continues structurally and systematically to this present day. You will hear testimony about the COINTELPRO, how the US government's once secret illegal campaign seeking to disrupt and destroy movements in general and those led by Black, Brown, and Indigenous populations in particular was manifest. You will hear comparisons that US political prisoners who fought against United States apartheid are no different than the late President Nelson Mandela, who headed South Africa's African National Congress and eventually was forced to lead armed struggle against the sustained and the systemic violence, racial violence, abuse, and oppression of South African apartheid. You will learn that the United States intentionally inflicts bodily harm on Black, Brown, and Indigenous people through environmental racism. Specifically, you will hear witness testimony that the United States knowingly created and negligently ignored the Flint water crisis, failed to produce and enforce environmental regulations in Louisiana's Cancer Alley, and deliberately inflicted conditions of life that will bring about physical destruction in the face of natural disasters. Finally, you will learn that the United States has created a health crisis that aids in the destruction in whole or in part of Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, creating conditions of genocide through the promulgation of an environment that results in inequitable health conditions that disproportionately and deliberately impact members of the plaintiff class. Through these conditions, the United States has created a mental health crisis, increased infant mortality rates, and increased rates of disease and death. You will hear testimony that the United States has created the mental health crisis through historically oppressive systems, facilitated an inaccessible healthcare system, resulting in disproportionate health issues in the Black community, and constructed harmful living spaces that triggers disease, delays in biological developments, and often death, and has done so intentionally.
That was Chief People's Counsel Nkechi Taifa. Next, we'll hear a small sample of the testimony supporting the 5 counts of human rights abuses against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. First, we'll hear an expert witness who testified on the systematic pattern of police violence against and killings of Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. Malina Abdullah is a professor and former department chair of Pan-African Studies at California State University in Los Angeles. She's also a board member of the National Conference of Black Studies and a founding member of Black Lives Matter LA.
The targeting, the violent targeting of Black people by police is the way the institution was set up. So the system of policing in this country descends from the system of slave catching. It descends from chattel slavery. It was meant intentionally to put targets on the backs of Black people. And so the killings of our people at the hands of police are not isolated incidents. They are systemic and they are the intent of the system. They are not a failure of the system. Many of us have been involved in movements that were based on, or uprisings that were based on, single incidents. And we'd been involved, and for instance, in 2009, I was deeply involved in the movement for justice for Oscar Grant, right? Who was murdered by police on a BART platform in Oakland, California. Many of us had been in the streets after Sean Bell was killed, or after Margaret Mitchell was killed, or after Devin Brown was killed. What happened when Trayvon Martin was murdered by a wannabe cop, by a wannabe neighborhood watchman, a wannabe white man, George Zimmerman, is that we were reminded that these incidents, again, are not isolated. It is not just about justice for Trayvon Martin, although we have to absolutely uplift his name and embrace him as a real being, not just a hashtag. And we also have to remember that his stolen life is connected with the stolen life of Emmett Till and the stolen life of Oscar Grant. And so what Black Lives Matter was about was remembering that we have to build a movement that is designed to end the systems, end the institutions that deliberately steal the lives of Black people.
That was Malina Abdullah, professor of Pan-African Studies. The second count was mass incarceration. Salim Robert Holbrook is executive director of the Abolitionist Law Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He has also worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Campaign to End Solitary Confinement. Salim testified about the systematic pattern of criminalization of people of color, especially youth, at levels far above any other country, and the legal structures that allow imposition of cruel, draconian sentences. Robert Salim Holbrook.
Abolitionist Law Center was founded to address the race and class-based discrimination in this system, but also the disregard and the abuse that Black life faces in America, Black and brown life faces in America, particularly Black youth who are caught up in the criminal justice system. For me personally, my experience guides the Abolitionist Law Center's work, because as someone who at the age of 16 years old was facing the death sentence and was sentenced to spend the rest of my life in prison, ultimately served 27 years in prison, 10 of those in solitary confinement. The longest I spent consecutively was 3 years. Our work was born out of that experience, but more importantly, not just my experience, because I don't want to just center myself, but it was born out of the experience of political prisoners in Pennsylvania. Because it was political prisoners when I was buried in that hole, me and other children who came through, when we were being preyed upon, it was political prisoners who embraced us, who protected us, who built us up, in many cases became our fathers. And so for me, that guides our work, right? Because to come home and be released and forget about them who helped us at our lowest moments, that's something that, you know, as a human being, I just was not raised by like that. And they did not raise us like that. When I say we're a dismantling project, I don't take that lightly. We meet the state where they're at. We're willing to fight just as hard as they are against us, because that's the regime that we come out of. That's our experiences. And I would like to live in a society one day where there's no need for an Abolitionist Law Center, right? That's what we're working for. But as long as we have oppression, racism, as long as we have Black youth being murdered in the street, Black youth being sentenced to die in prison, and brown youth and women, there's going to be a need for an Abolitionist Law Center and people who are going to fight as hard as we fight, inspired and motivated by the legacy of Black resistance and political prisoners in this country. So the Eighth Amendment, yeah, let's talk about the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment in this country. The Eighth Amendment allowed the state of Pennsylvania to keep Russell Maroon Schultz in solitary confinement for 30 years. The Eighth Amendment allowed the state of Pennsylvania to keep Joseph Jojo Bowens continuously in solitary confinement for 34 years. The Eighth Amendment allowed the state of Pennsylvania to keep Fred Muhammad Burton in solitary confinement for 19 years. The Eighth Amendment in Pennsylvania allowed the state to keep Arthur Chettaway Johnson in continued solitary confinement for 39 years. All of these were political prisoners, and they were in the hole for a reason, because the state wanted to separate them from us. The state did not want us to speak to them. Actually, the state was saying that if you want to be like them, this is they're the example for you. You will be in the hole for decades. But we rejected that model because they were giving us something. They were giving us life while the state was taking it. So it's like the state was strangling us and they were resuscitating us. So we was like, I'm going to go with what's giving me air, not with what's taking my life. The only thing I can say about solitary confinement is solitary confinement is every individual person's own particular hell. That's the best way of describing it. But the conditions, look, you know, you're in a cell in many of our cases with just a pair of boxers, a t-shirt. You might be lucky if you get flip-flops, a couple books, a sheet, toilet paper. And the remarkable thing I find about that is that I've been in a cell completely naked with nothing in that cell. And I would see a lieutenant come and look in that cell and stand there and figure out what more could he take? What more could they take? And it was in those moments that I realized that there's nothing else that you could take, right? that's the mentality that you have to survive. But if you don't have that mentality, those are the people, unfortunately, who are going to take their life.
Robert Salim Holbrook of the Abolitionist Law Center.
What is a political prisoner? What is a prisoner of war? A political prisoner, a person held in confinement because of their support of or identity with a people struggling for freedom from an oppressive government or against its oppressive policies. A prisoner of war, a national combatant of an oppressed nation held in confinement by the oppressor nation because of their support of or identity with the oppressed nation's war for self-determination, independence, or national liberation from the oppressor nation. What did these political prisoners stand for? All is outlined in the Black Panthers 10-point program.
We want freedom. We want the power to determine the destiny of our Black and oppressed communities.
We want full employment for our people.
We want an end to the robbery by the capitalists of our Black and oppressed communities.
We want decent housing fit for the shelter of human beings.
We want decent education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us the true history of our people and the role and our role in the present day society.
We want completely free health care for all Black and oppressed people.
We want an immediate end to police brutality, murder of Black people, other people of color, all oppressed people inside the United States.
We want an immediate end to all wars of aggression.
We want freedom for all Black and oppressed people now held in US federal, state, county, city, and military prisons and jails. We want trials by a jury of peers for all persons charged with so-called crimes under the laws of this country.
We want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and the people's community control of modern technology.
First was Flute Music by Black long-term political prisoner Veronica Bowers, recorded over the phone from the federal prison where he's been forced to live for many years. After that was Spoken Word by Through the Walls Troop.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt of KPFT Houston.
And I'm Bob Lederer of WBAI New York. Next, you'll hear testimony about the holding of political prisoners and prisoners of war by the U.S. and state governments. The witness was himself a political prisoner for 49 years, Black Panther Jaleel Muntakim.
I was arrested on August 28, 1971. I was not released until October 2020, 49 years and a few months. I am the one who initiated the call for this tribunal. In 2018, I was held in solitary confinement. You heard Brother Salim talk about the conditions of solitary confinement. And I was sent to solitary confinement for teaching a class that was approved while I was in Attica Correctional Facility, teaching Black history. I am a veteran of the Black Panther Party and a veteran of the Black Liberation Army, proudly. There are two areas of concern for me in regards to what is COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was an operation by the federal government, by the FBI, to destroy any progressive, revolutionary, or national, or militant organization during the 50s and 60s and the 70s, right? Part of the idea of COINTELPRO was to neutralize a movement and to neutralize people. And this is the reason why we had the death of Fred Hampton. This is the reason why we had the death of Mark Clark. This is why you had the death of Bunchy Carter. and John Higgins and many others, by the virtue of the means by which COINTELPRO were operated to create dissension, to infiltrate, and to destroy a movement. COINTELPRO operated as one the government would do to destabilize a country, to destabilize a country, use every resource available to them to destroy the Black Panther Party. And by virtue of that, we fought back. It is very important to understand that our relationship to the state is one that is political, right? Our engaging to be incarcerated in the first place, to be in prison in the first place, is based upon our politics. Although they criminalize our politics, it's the only industrial nation in the world that I'm aware of who denies the existence of political prisoners. And we find that in the course of being in prison, this one of the things that they do not want us to do is teach prisoners to raise their consciousness, to remove their relationship of a criminal mentality to move one towards a revolutionary mentality. And for by virtue of that alone, we, political prisoners, are targeted inside prisons. We are targeted for segregation. We're targeted to be removed from the populations. We're targeted in every kind of way that we try to evolve ourselves inside prisons. They try to suppress it, right? Try to make it a non-entity while in prison. And in times, wow. I was eligible for parole in 2002. I was not released until 2020, right? Fighting these people to be released from prison. I got lucky, right? And so I was released on October 6, 2020. As soon as I was released from prison, they escorted me to see my parole officer. The parole officer put an ankle bracelet on my ankle, monitoring me for 6 months with an ankle bracelet. However, the parole officer told me to go to the Department of Social Services and see what benefits may be available to me since I had been recently released from prison after 50 years. When I went there, I filed some documents. One of the documents was to register to vote. Right? And by filing to register to vote, a pundit who did not, a right-wing pundit up in Rochester, where I now reside, the city of Frederick Douglass, the city of the greatest abolitionist that we've known in the history of Black America, they decided that they wanted to prosecute me for registering to vote, and they arrested me. 2 weeks after I was released, they arrested me in front of my moms.
And what happened after that?
We developed a campaign to fight back, and it took me about 4 or 5 months to have those charges dismissed. They knew they was wrong in the first place. We talked about the spirit of Mandela. We have what we call the Mandela Rule. Right? What is the standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners under the United Nations? And the United States is in violation of every one of those standards, primarily every one of those standards. Why? Because slavery in the United States has never been abolished. Understand what I'm saying? Slavery in America has never been abolished. It's been penalized. It's been put in the prison system. The 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution has an exception clause. The exception clause states that prison involuntary servitude should not exist in the United States except for those who've been duly convicted of a crime, the exception clause. Understand that. Now, the United States prison system is a slaveocracy, right? It's in the law. It's in the Constitution.
Former political prisoner Jalil Mutakin. Another former political prisoner released after serving decades was witness Oscar Lopez Rivera of the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. He starts by mentioning the charge of seditious conspiracy brought against him and 10 colleagues.
With my co-defendants and the way that seditious conspiracy was used as an instrument of punishment to punish us as much as the U.S. government could. And we were probably sent to the worst prisons and the worst conditions. I think that within us, we can do it, we can struggle, we can defeat the enemy, and we can be victorious. So let's think like that, and we hope that, I hope that soon, one day, Puerto Rico will be a free and independent nation, and that every one of you can visit Puerto Rico, because we're hoping to have an Edenic Garden in the Caribbean for those who dare to struggle for those who want justice and freedom in this world.
Oscar Lopez Rivera, Puerto Rican independence leader. fourth count of the indictment is systemic environmental racism. First, we'll hear from Nathan Phillips, an elder of the Omaha people.
Nathan Phillips. I'm from the Omaha tribe. Tapa is my clan. Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island I represent. We were original peoples of Nebraska. And because they denied the system to take me away and teach me English and different, you know, and become a different religion, you know, my dad resisted that. So the social services said that my family was unfit. One of the things about genocide is that they say they take the children away from their families and put them in a foreign system. That is exactly what happened to me. When I was 5 years old, 1960, Lincoln, Nebraska, the social service people, with the help of the Lincoln Police Department, in the middle of the night, broke my mom's door down. I was 5 years old. They stole me away. I only knew my Omaha language. Now I don't know it. I was stolen away. I was denied my language, my culture, and the love of my mom and my dad. I was placed in an abusive foster home. The people beat me mercilessly. And I was told and made to say, I love you to them. Yes, I've suffered. See, I have an Indian name, but I don't know it now. Because when my mom died, she was the one who knew that name. I don't know my own Indian name. I should know that.
Indigenous Elder Nathan Phillips. Now we'll hear from Imani Jacqueline Brown, a researcher at the Center for Research Architecture at the University of London, who has worked for environmental justice at RISE St. James in New Orleans, Louisiana.
So RISE and the Center for Constitutional Rights asked us to help them investigate environmental racism throughout Louisiana's petrochemical corridor, which is also known as Cancer Alley, as described in the indictment. Cancer Alley is defined in many different ways, depending on whether we're measuring the region along the river or otherwise, but it's an 85-mile stretch of land between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, where over 200 formerly slave-powered sugarcane plantations are now occupied by some of the most polluting oil and gas production facilities in the United States. In 2019, four cemeteries that hold the remains of historically enslaved people were identified by an archaeology firm that was hired by RISE St. James. One cemetery had likely already been destroyed many years ago by a waste retention pond on the Mosaic Corporation's diammonium phosphate fertilizer plant. The other three are at risk of desecration by the construction of Formosa Plastics' new facility, which they call the Sunshine Project. So why, of course, are there these cemeteries of enslaved people on these industrial sites and industrial construction sites? We learned from RISE and from this archaeology firm that historically, every single plantation had at least one and sometimes as many as three cemeteries for enslaved people. As such, if Cancer Alley, the petrochemical corridor, which was formerly constituted by hundreds of sugarcane plantations and formerly known as Plantation Country. Cancer Alley was formerly known as Plantation Country, and there are upwards of 500 plantations between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. As such, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of historical antebellum Black cemeteries that are at risk from future industrial activity, in addition to those that have already been desecrated by the existing 200 or so facilities in the region. In addition, of course, to desecrating historic cemeteries, existing and future industrial facilities poison the air of these historic majority Black communities that populate this area and that were founded by emancipated peoples in the years after the Civil War. So RISE St. James and the Center for Constitutional Rights asked Forensic Architecture to assist them in identifying these lost and erased cemeteries for historically enslaved people, and also to draw into visibility the other chemical emissions, the invisible chemical emissions that saturate the air and that majority Black residents of this region are forced to breathe. In order to try to develop a predictive method for locating historic cemeteries throughout the region, we sourced and analyzed a collection of primary source documents that span 300 years, including historic maps, aerial photography, and satellite imaging. As we combined these materials, we were able to build a digital portal through which we could study the transformation of the land across these decades. We also discerned the spatial logics of the industrial sugarcane plantation. We decoded the symbology used to represent some cemeteries, which are mapped, as well as other structures such as slave quarters and the slave master's big house, as well as other landmarks. And we learned to read the surface of the earth as visible through these historic aerial photographs, discerning traces of the past that have been left off of the maps, and also tracking the transformation and persistence of racialized land use practices across the various developmental stages of corporate colonial capitalism in this region. Through this research process, we were able to identify over 1,000 probable sites of historic and cultural value, including antebellum Black cemeteries, hundreds of which have already been topographically erased by industrial development over the decades, which does not consider Black cultural and historic sites to be worthy of preservation.
Imani Jacqueline Brown, environmental researcher and activist. The final charge was racism in public health. Dr. Mary Louise Patterson is a retired pediatrician affiliated with Weill Cornell Medicine, who is a board member of Physicians for a National Health Program in New York City. She opened with a tribute to her father for his key role in the trailblazing 1951 petition to the UN titled We Charge Genocide.
I'm here tonight representing my father, William L. Patterson, who dedicated his entire life to the valiant struggle against racism. 70 years ago, he co-authored and courageously advanced a petition that charged the U.S. government with genocide. For what other label would accurately describe the near annihilation, then betrayal, banishment, erasure of the remaining First Nation peoples, followed by the stealing of their children, and or the 400 plus years of terror and indescribable heinous brutality of the offspring of the millions of violently kidnapped Africans, and or the racism and discrimination of Latinx Americans who fled here because of impossible living conditions in their home countries, conditions created by U.S. capital and enforced by the U.S. military. There is no other label for all of those crimes other than genocide. So happy 70th anniversary to We Charge Genocide. And thank you, Dad, Paul Robeson, and the many other courageous comrades who, by signing that petition, put their lives and the well-being of their families on the line. Incidentally, they also highlighted how genocide practiced at home was a central ingredient of U.S. foreign imperial policy. I know all of you recall Dr. Martin Luther King's statement about healthcare in this country. He said, and I quote, "Of all of the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most inhumane." All of you know only too well that there is racism in healthcare, that glaring healthcare and health inequities and disparities exist, for how could they not? All of our institutions, healthcare institutions included, our entire culture, this country's founding laws and practices are supersaturated with racism and have been since the arrival of Europeans. I don't think I have to tell you that there is not one healthcare index that African Americans, First Nation or Latinx people don't suffer from worse. But we can't leave poor whites out of this picture. Yes, poor white people also have poorer healthcare indices and outcomes than their richer relatives, as they only have to be dispensed slightly better, or what appears to be slightly better healthcare than what is dispensed to African Americans. Institutional and structural racism is reflected in discriminatory healthcare policies, in the underfunding of preventive care, in the fewer and poorer quality healthcare facilities that are chronically understaffed and under-resourced, in the rationing of care, in racist curricula in medical nursing and social work schools, in fewer doctors and nurses of color, in the denial of or limited access to the latest treatments or best medications, in the inaccessibility of long-term care, in the leaving out of government coverage for glasses, hearing aids, dental care, in the implicit biases prejudices, lack of respect, and common courtesies heaped upon and endured by patients of color. All of these, along with the detrimental impact of the chronic exposure to elevated stress hormone levels plus, are culpable in the existence and persistence of the racial disparities, the greater morbidity and mortality from acute and chronic illnesses, and the negative healthcare outcomes so well documented in the scientific and popular media. Yes, Latinx, African American, First Nation, Indian Americans, and Pacific Islanders, infant mortality is more than thrice that of whites, and our maternal mortality is more than twice that of whites. Our longevity is at least 7 years less, not to mention the poorer quality of that longevity. What about the undisclosed or forced sterilizations of thousands of Black women in the South, indigenous women on reservations, and of women in Puerto Rico, from racist police brutality to healthy food deserts to dilapidated, underfunded, and under-resourced schools, to generations of unemployment and or employment in the most dangerous and dirty jobs, to homelessness, poverty, and hunger, while images of a pretty, clean, safe, fun life and beautifully decorated home are flaunted every night on our TV. For many of us, that life is only a few bus or subway stops away, but we can't have it. Doesn't all of that reflect the partial destruction or annihilation of a people? I contend it does.
Dr. Mary Louise Patterson, Physicians for a National Health Program.
We will not bow down to our
racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down.
Exploitation. I'm going to stay. I'm gonna stand. I'm gonna stand.
I just can't tolerate
racism.
I just can't tolerate no
injustice.
I just can't tolerate
exploitation. I'm gonna stand.
That was I'm Gonna Stand by Sweet Honey in the Rock. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Bob Lederer of WBAI New York.
And I'm Akua Holt of KPFT Houston. After 2 days of witness testimony, People's Attorney Nkechi Taifa summarized the case for the jurists. She emphasized the historical intent underlining all the particular charges of what she deemed institutional genocide against people of color in the United States.
As you know, esteemed jurists, international law understands that racism manifests in various forms, allowing intent to be gleaned through actions and impact. For example, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which the United States has ratified but not made self-executing, allows laws and practices that have an invidious discriminatory impact to be condemned regardless of specific impact, reaching both conscious as well as unconscious forms of racism. Thus, my argument has always been, ever since the adoption of CERD, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination in 1994, that if the intent standard of the Genocide Convention, even with its limitations as ratified by the United States, if the Genocide Convention were to be interpreted in accordance with the intent standard and CERD, the International Race Convention, that the paradigm of genocide against a substantial portion of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in the United States resulting from institutionalized or structural racism is not just plausible, but actionable. Indeed, there is historical intent in all the categories outlined in the indictment Just as there is unquestionably racially discriminatory impact in each as well, we still charge genocide. Leaving the intent prong aside for a moment, let's go back to that definition of genocide and analyze how the impact of racism could fit that mode. In this vein, I took the liberty to coin the term institutional genocide as a legitimate formulation that illuminized the severity inherent in the international nomenclature, while acknowledging that there may be complications in some people's minds with the U.S. interpretation of intent. What is institutionalized genocide? I submit it is the aggregate impact of discriminatory treatment of an impacted community embedded in laws, policies, and practices of institutions involved in mass incarceration. Policing, prosecutions, environmental racism, health disparities, all described in this indictment, so not limited to these categories, which have the effect of destroying in whole or substantial part a racial, ethnic, or religious group.
People's attorney, Nkechi Taifa, during her closing statement at the International Tribunal on Human Rights Abuses Against Black, Brown, and Indigenous Peoples. On October 25th, the panel of jurists unanimously found the United States guilty of all five counts, which they concluded fit well within the internationally accepted definition of genocide. Next, we hear their reading of the verdict, first by Chief Jurist Magdalene Moonsami, former member of the South African Parliament, followed by Shirley Fabre, Haitian-born UN representative of the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, and finally by Kasahun Chikole, Eritrean-born CEO of Africa World Red Sea Press.
The panel of jurists heard testimony emphasizing millions upon millions of indigenous and African peoples murdered, disappeared, and nearly exterminated over a period from 1492 through the present. Further, the witnesses and prosecution argued that the wrongs have been historic and deliberate. With colonization, racism, militarism, imperialism, criminalization, patriarchy, neocolonialism, and internal colonialism as a part of the larger process that now manifests itself in medical and digital apartheid, chemical warfare, environmental violence and racism, divestment, and a pandemic of accessible guns and drugs, with the majority of gun violence perpetrated by the police and security forces in the false claim of upholding law and order. Statements were made testifying to new forms of colonialism, which include the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, and the commercialization of our health and privatization and commodification of all social services. The testimonies we heard also included substantial evidence on the erasure of histories, distortion and cultural misappropriation contributes to and exacerbates the attempted invisibilization and denial of people's basic humanity.
Testimonies of this tribunal reaffirm the traditional wisdom and knowledge of Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. Strong evidence was presented on the indomitable, unbreakable resistance and resilience of the people's struggle for justice and dignity. In the face of egregious human rights violations and crimes against humanity, this spirit of collective survival shone through. The accused, though informed, did not respond to the charges and indictment against them, nor did they appear as invited to present a defense.
After having heard the testimony of numerous victims of police racism, mass incarceration, environmental racism, public health inequities, and of political prisoners, prisoners of war, together with expert testimonies and graphic presentations, as well as the copious documentation submitted and admitted in the record, the panel of jurists find the U.S. and its subdivisions are guilty of all five counts. Further, we find grounds that the actus of genocide had been committed.
That was Tribunal jurist Magdalene Musami, Shirley Fabry, and Kashan Chikoli reading the panel's verdict. Finally, we'll hear comments on the verdict by jurist Wilma Ravarang Koyasu, a longtime member of the Puerto Rican Bar Association and former executive director of the Puerto Rican Center for Research, which worked with the United Nations.
And it is in the people, in the power of the people, in their communities, who are the ones that are doing every day, that are the ones that are addressing all these nefarious actions that have been summed up in the verdict that we just heard read. It is in that action taken by a mother defending the right of their children to education, by that action taken by a community defending the right of a prisoner to have adequate health care during prison sentencing, to have an adequate procedure, to have an adequate defense at any stage of the proceeding. It is the work of the people who organize against environmental impact, the people of Flint fighting for the right to clean water, the people of Louisiana fighting for an adequate protection against climate change, flooding, and all the impact that they have received of climate crisis. That's where the power is.
Jurist Wilma Reveron Collazo.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. And just one of the verses, some of you all know this. Until the killing of black men, brown men, indigenous men, black women, brown women, indigenous women, black children, brown children, indigenous children. Until this killing stops, we will not rest. Until the killing of all these peoples is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers' sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it's won. It doesn't come. We bring it.
That was the voice of jurist Dr. Vicky Casanova Willis, former executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network and past president of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. As a triumphal note for this historic tribunal, on the final day, a Pennsylvania judge ruled that Russell Maroon Schoetz, 78, a Black Panther political prisoner since 1972, would be freed on compassionate release because of his stage 4 cancer. Days later, white anti-imperialist political prisoner David Gilbert, 77, was released on parole after serving 40 years in New York State prisons. The freedom of both people had been demanded by years-long grassroots campaigns. Campaigns continue seeking humanitarian release of other elder political prisoners who have been mistreated in prison for, in some cases, up to 5 decades. The In the Spirit of Mandela Coalition, which assembled the tribunal, will use the verdict to organize across many social justice arenas to bring the findings of genocide to a much broader audience nationally and internationally. To watch videos of the tribunal, or for more information, visit www.tribunal2021.com. That's www.tribunal2021.com, or go to spiritofmandela.org. That's spiritofmandela.org. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates that contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the extraordinary efforts of executive producer Polina Vasiliev, along with executive producers Akua Holt, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Bob Lederer, with assistance from Anthony Fest, Thomas O'Rourke, Matt Meyer, Aisha Muhammad, and John Riley.
You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. I've been your host along with Bob Lederer. Thanks for listening.